All right, got it going here. Excellent. All right, so I'm going to sit on the table because I noticed you were having to do this to see me, so I can sit in a chair. So yeah, I'm John Oakes. I'm 64 years old. I've been a Christian for 40 years, so I've been around a little bit. I'll explain my upbringing a little bit. So I grew up in a traditional Protestant kind of home. Not Lutheran, which is the state religion here, yes, but Episcopalian, which is almost the same thing. And so I took part in the ritual, and I was the guy who would carry the cross. Did they have that in church and wear the robes and stuff like that? But I didn't believe in God. In fact, I was an atheist. In fact, really, I was mainly a pot smoker. You know, that was my main thing I did in high school. And so I went off to college. My sophomore, junior year in college, because I was studying physics and chemistry, I realized that there has to be a God of some sort, because the nature of science and the universe and everything told me there has to be a God. So then I began to search, you know, because I'd grown up in a Christian perspective and because I was, you know, in my early 20s, I did not want to go in the direction my parents brought me. So I was very attracted to Hinduism and Buddhism, Eastern religion. And so I stopped doing all those, you know, drinking, smoking dope, and all those silly things that I had done. And so it's about 2 or 3 years. And then at the age of 23, almost 24, I came across a church which showed... they caught my attention because of the love they had for each other. And they got me to read the Bible. And I read the Bible. I came to the conclusion that it was true. I became a Christian. So I've been a Christian now for 40 years. I've been a chemistry and physics professor most of that time. I have my PhD in chemical physics. And I have 3 children. I have a teaching ministry. I do Christian evidence talks. I've taught in 80 different countries. I've written about 13 or 14 books. And I just love meeting people, especially young people. So is that enough background?
Yeah, that's perfect.
All right. I don't like talking about myself too much. Okay, great. So tonight I want to talk about Jesus. Okay? Pretty basic topic, huh? So I want to ask the question, who is Jesus? All right, and now I'm going to propose, apparently I must have taught this in Thailand, apparently. So I'm going to propose a few possible explanations of who Jesus is. Some people say Jesus is a sage. Does anybody know what that is? Maybe the equivalent would be a guru. Okay? Some people say that Jesus was a wise man. All right? Now, for those of you of a Christian background, would you say that Jesus was a wise man?
Yes.
Okay. So maybe that's a legitimate description. Some people say he was a prophet. Other people say he was a liar, that he made claims about himself that weren't true. Some people say he was crazy. In fact, his own family seemed to think maybe he was crazy, right? I'm going to move this thing so I can see what you're seeing. Because right now, do I have enough wire? Yes. Perfect. Some people say he's the Messiah. Some people say Son of Man. Now, that's an interesting label. What is Son of Man? Because Ezekiel is called Son of Man, and Daniel is called Son of Man. Some people say he's God in the flesh. Some people say he's really just a legend. The organization that I'm a president of, we put on a debate with a guy who said the Jesus of the Bible is a legend. He's a myth. He's really a creation of, you know, these people to taking all the different Near Eastern myths, and they created Jesus out of that. Some people say he's a man. By that, what they mean is just a man. Some people say he's an important religious leader amongst many religious leaders. This, I believe, is the most common idea about Jesus, probably in Norway, most likely. It's certainly in the younger generation in the U.S. People say that, you know, there's many different... Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, okay, whatever. Oh, we're going to have to... Oh, my goodness. That's very distracting. We may not be able to use this thing. Is that going to drive you crazy?
Do you have the same on your screen?
No.
See, if you take out the cable and put it back in...
Okay.
Your life will be good.
My life will be good. Yeah. My life's already good.
Ah!
Miracle. Ask a smart guy. So here's what I want to do. Ah.
I'm sorry.
All right. So here's what I want to do. I want to address this claim that Jesus is kind of like Muhammad, kind of like Krishna, Joseph Smith, Confucius, Buddha. They're all kind of different path. You know, there's that idea that they're all just a different path to the same place. Very common idea. Okay, so I'm going to ask a question. Confucius, what did he say about himself? You know who Confucius is, right? He was the creator of the national religion of China, called Confucianism, following this philosopher Confucius. Okay? So, does anybody know anything about what Confucius said about himself? I guess I'll have to tell you then. Confucius said that he was a wise man who had a very wise system for human life. Okay? In other words, he said he was a sage. Did Confucius claim to work miracles? No. Did he claim to be a prophet? No. Did he? Basically, all he claimed to be was a wise person to offer wise advice. Okay, let's not talk about Joseph Smith. Do you know who Joseph Smith is? He created Mormonism. Let's not talk about him. Okay, good. How about Buddha? What did Buddha claim about himself? Anybody know? Right, he claimed that he was enlightened. He claimed that he had a wise path. He had the four noble truths and the eightfold path to enlightenment. Did he claim to be inspired by God? No. Did he claim to work miracles? Or to be a prophet? No. He claimed to have a wise means of how to live our life. And from what I know of Buddha, I actually like him. In fact, if you read about his four noble truths and his eightfold path to enlightenment, I think we'd find ourselves agreeing with all those things as good things. In fact, the only thing I don't like about Buddha that I know of is that he abandoned his wife and his children. So that's not such a good thing. Okay, how about Moses? What did Moses say about himself? They don't study comparative religion. All right. What did Moses... Surely some of you know. Maybe you're just being quiet. What did Moses say about himself? He made much bigger claims about himself than Buddha ever did. Okay, go for it.
That God made him go take the Israelites out of Egypt.
All right. He claimed that God spoke to him directly. Mm-hmm. Okay. He claimed that God spoke to him directly. What else did Moses claim? I could go back to the list. Maybe we need to go back to the list. All right. Which of these things did Moses claim to be that we haven't mentioned yet? You didn't realize you'd have to think a little bit. You thought I'd just be... Yes.
Prophet.
Right. Moses claimed to be a prophet, okay? and he claimed to have direct revelation from God. Okay, now let's do Muhammad. I don't know if you see the little cartoon. Thanks for your drawing, Billy, but now we have to kill you. He made a drawing of Muhammad. That's a, I don't know if it's okay to use that joke, but okay. I've given this lesson in Muslim countries, and when I do, I took that one out. It's not funny in Muslim countries. But anyway, what did Muhammad claim about himself? Right, he claimed to be a prophet. In fact, Muhammad's claims about himself are almost identical to Moses' claims about himself. He claimed to be a prophet, and he claimed to have direct revelation received not from God, but from the angel Gabriel. All right? And so did Muhammad claim to work miracles? No. Did Moses claim to work miracles? Well, not exactly. He claimed that God worked miracles through him or around him. Okay, let me see. Let's see if we have any other important religious leaders. How about Lao Tzu, who began the religion Taoism? Lao Tzu made claims very, very similar to that of Buddha. He claimed to have a wise path towards enlightenment. All right, so people say, oh, there's many different paths to the same place. I can follow Muhammad up this path, or I can follow Buddha up this path, or Bahá'u'lláh, the Baha'i religion. Do they have Baha'i here? Probably, it's everywhere. All right, some people say all different paths to the same place. Now, what I want to do is I want to talk about what Jesus claimed. And let me tell you my conclusion before I even start. My conclusion is, to put Jesus in the group with these other men is a logic error. It doesn't really make sense. Okay? So, in fact, I believe if we look at the claims of Jesus, we'll have to conclude either that he's a crazy man or a real big liar. Either that or he's unique amongst all who have ever lived. And there's no comparison. In fact, to put him in the other group is doesn't even make sense. So let's look at some of the claims that Jesus made. John 5:39. All right, I don't have a Bible here, but maybe some of you do. Jesus, he was speaking to the teachers of the law and the Pharisees, the people who had a doctorate in theology, essentially. And he said to them, you've been studying the scriptures your whole life, but you missed the most important point. All these scriptures are about me. So what Jesus said is this. He said to Jewish people, he said, your entire religion and all of your scripture points towards me. Okay? All right, let's see how this goes. Levi, stand up, please. Would you make this claim, for us. In other words, that the entire scripture is written about you.
Yeah. I'm going to say that?
Yeah, yeah.
In Norwegian? No?
Sure, yeah. Sure, Norwegian. Yeah.
Altså, alle skriftene i Bibelen, alt det som du leser her, det handler om meg.
Okay, wait a minute.
That was the wrong way.
Now, do it a second time.
Yeah.
But this time, do it with very, very deep conviction.
Okay.
Okay.
Det som dere leser hver dag, klart.
No, he's failing. Never mind. I'll do it for him. I'll do it for you.
Yeah, do it for me.
Yeah. I'll start again. No, never mind. It's just impossible. I mean, seriously, because when Levi says that, your first response is like, ha, lying. But then he looks at you and he says, I'm serious. I'm telling you, the entire Old Testament was written about me. Then what are you thinking? He's not joking. So now what are you thinking? He's crazy. But Jesus actually said this. Now, I don't know, maybe it's just my scientific upbringing, but to me, either what he said is true, or it's not. I think those are the only two alternatives. And if it's not true, then who is Jesus? Is he a good person? So these are the kinds of claims I'd like us to look at. Let's look at some others, okay? I think I do need to pull out my Bible for this one. I'm going to go to John chapter 6. All right. Pull out my trusty Bible. I'm leading Bible studies on campus at the college in my town. And so it's all college students plus me. And I'm the only one who has a Bible. It's pretty funny. So what it would do is we try to have a race to see who can find the verse quicker. It's almost equal. All right, John chapter 6. Ready? Go. John. Oh, you already turned. That's no fair. You're beating me. Okay. John 6:35. Let's listen to what Jesus said about himself. John 6, verse 35. Then Jesus declared, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty." I have to pick on an adult, so I have another adult over here. Ronnie.
Yes.
Let's go. Come on. Now, here's the thing. In fact, actually, let's go down to verse 51. Listen to what Jesus says in verse 51. Listen to this. He says, "I am the living bread who came down from heaven. Whoever eats this bread will live forever. This bread is my flesh, which will I give for the life of the world." Did Muhammad ever say something like this? No? Did Confucius ever say something even remotely like this? In fact, has anybody ever said anything remotely like this? The answer is yeah. At the crazy place. Okay? Right? What's Jesus saying about himself? He says, look at this. "I am the bread of life. I am the living bread. Whoever eats this bread will live forever." Jesus says, whoever eats me will live forever. That's crazy stuff. So when he says, "whoever eats me," do you think that they understood exactly what he meant, right? He says, "whoever comes to me and learns from me, I will give him or her eternal life." All right. Did Moses say something like this? What about Joseph Smith? What any other religious leader? Look at this. In verse 41, after he said, "I'm the bread of life," at this the Jews there began to grumble about him because he said, "I'm the bread of that came down from heaven." They said, "Isn't this Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How can he say, 'I'm the bread of life'?" Now, what had Jesus done just a couple of hours before he made this statement? Ah, well, he did that too. But how about making bread? He made enough bread to feed 5,000 men plus women and children, probably 12,000 people. From nothing, he made bread. Jesus had a way of working miracles that kind of sort of made his claims a bit more believable. Now, let's go to John 8:46. John 8:46. Here we go. John 8:46. Jesus says, "Can any of you prove me guilty of sin? If I'm telling the truth, why don't you believe in me?" All right. So who should we pick for this one? Okay. Yeah, there you go. Right. So can anybody prove me guilty of sin? Except, I guess, in Norwegian. Raise your hand. Raise your hand. Anybody? Okay. Imagine this. What's Jesus claiming? To be sinless. To be perfect. Has anybody ever claimed that? No. Except a crazy person. And yeah, I like to imagine that I was there in that crowd. I like to imagine, because there were people there who'd known Jesus for quite a while. And I think they're probably said, wait a minute, there's that one time. No, I guess not. Oh, what about? Look at the response. Verse 48. And the Jews answered, aren't we right in saying you're Samaritan and demon-possessed? Notice what they did not say. They did not say, well, what about the time you did this? As I'm sure they would have done with you, right? And this included people who'd known him for a very long time. And no one said, well, what about the time you did this? There was no rational answer to his claims. So what did they say instead? Put it in modern terms. What did they say instead? Crazy. Right. They said, this guy's crazy. But that doesn't make sense, because how could a crazy person be sinless? So my conclusion is, the people who knew Jesus very well recognized the truth of what he said. Has anybody claimed this? And the answer, simple answer is no. But let's go to the next one. How about John 8, verse 58? Let me back up a little bit, because Jesus is having a discussion. The discussion he's having with the Jewish people, with the leaders, including some who believed and some who did not, the discussion is over his authority to say what he was saying. Because the Jewish leader said, who's this guy? Where does he get his authority? And so he's establishing his authority to speak. So in verse 54, Jesus replied, if I glorify myself, my glory means nothing. My Father, whom you claim as your God, is the one who glorifies me. Though you do not know him, I know him. If I said I did not, I would be a liar like you. But I do know him, and I obey his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day, and he saw it and was glad. You are not yet 50 years old, they said to him, and you have seen Abraham? Look at his response. Very truly I tell you, Jesus answered, before Abraham was born, I am. What did Jesus just claim? He didn't say, before Abraham was born, I was. That would be very different. Instead, he said, before Abraham was born, I am. What is Jesus claiming? Yeah.
That he has always been?
Yes. But what's the implication of that? Let's let an older person step in, okay? What's he claiming about himself?
I'm God.
He's claiming to be God. Because when Moses met God at the burning bush, he said to God, who should I say sent me? And God said, I am. When God says, I am, what does that mean? That means I'm the pre-existent one. I am the uncaused cause of the universe. Jesus was claiming to be the uncaused cause of the universe. And people say, well, you know, Moses, Muhammad, Krishna, Jesus. Oh, wait a minute, what about Krishna? That's not even a real person. Okay? Now, look at their reaction here. At this, they picked up stones to stone him, but Jesus hid himself, slipping away in the temple grounds. Does it make sense, based on what he said, that they picked up stones to stone him? Does that make sense? Absolutely, it makes sense. You know, I think the average Norwegian's response to Jesus was, pretty good guy. One of the best. Mahatma Gandhi, you know, Martin Luther King, Jesus, you know, Buddha. But that doesn't make sense. Because what if Jesus was not God? What if Jesus was not God? Then what would he be?
A liar
and a very, very dangerous person. And certainly we should not call him a good person unless he is, in fact, God in the flesh. Okay? And in fact, if you look at the responses to Jesus during his lifetime, the average response you see on the street to Jesus is not one of the responses that happened. People either, you know, fell at his feet or wanted to kill him. But nobody said, wow, what a nice guy. There's no evidence that anybody ever said, what a nice guy. Oh, let's look at another one. John 10, verse 30. It's kind of similar, so we'll look at it quickly. We'll go through this quickly. All right? Let me see. John 10, verse 29 and 30. My Father who has given to me is greater than all. No one can snatch them out of my Father's hand. I and the Father are one. Now, this statement could have two possible interpretations. One possible interpretation is, me and God, we're really close. That's one possible interpretation. Either that or he's saying, I'm God. So which was it? Let's see. At this, his Jewish opponents picked up stones to stone him. But Jesus said to them, I've shown you many good works from the Father. For which of these do you stone me? We are not stoning you for any good work, they replied, but for blasphemy. Because you, a mere man, claim to be God. Jesus says, No. I'm not claiming to be God. I'm just saying me and God are just really close. No, that's not what happened. And Jesus didn't say, you know, because if Jesus is not God, I think he better correct them right away, right? But that's not what happened. Who is this guy? You know, it seems like the choices are fairly narrow here. And if we go back to our list, you know, by the way, you could be more than one of the things on that list. For example, you could be Messiah and Son of God. You could even be a wise person and Messiah. All right, but you can't be a liar and the Son of God, that's for sure. Let's look at one more. This is kind of my favorite one. I really love this one. John 11. And by the way, there are many other claims of Jesus, but we're getting a pretty good list here. John 11, verses 25 and 26. Now, I have to give you the background. Jesus, as you know, was a worker of many miracles. In fact, thousands and thousands flocked from neighboring regions just so they could be around him in the hopes that he would heal them. And Peter, when he gave his first sermon there on Pentecost, he said, Jesus is a worker of signs, wonders, and miracles, as you know, everybody knows. So anyway, Jesus had three very close friends. That was Lazarus, Mary, and Martha. In fact, the evidence is Lazarus, Mary, and Martha probably were closer friends of Jesus even than some of his apostles. Very, very close friends. Whenever he came to Jerusalem, he stayed at their house. So anyway, Lazarus got sick. He was very sick, so they sent to Jesus, said, Jesus, come, your friend Lazarus is dying. And of course, they're assuming that he would come, right? But he did not come. And as you read the story, you see why not. So Lazarus dies. 4 days later, Jesus shows up. All right? He shows up there at Bethany. And so now he's going to have a little discussion with Martha, the brother of Lazarus and very, very close friend of Jesus. So I'll read in verse 21. Lord, Martha said to Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha answered, I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. But Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing me will never die. Do you believe this? And I believe that as John put this in his book, his intention was for everyone here to ask this same question. And here's the question is, do you believe this? What did Jesus say? He said that if we believe in him, we will be raised from the dead and we'll have eternal life. In fact, this is actually pretty similar to what he said back in John chapter 6 when he said, I'm the bread of life and those who feed upon me will live even though they die. Right, but Jesus had a way of doing a miracle immediately after making a claim which sort of was related to the claim. So, let's go ahead. Let's go to verse 38. Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. Take away the stone, he said. But Lord, said Martha, the sister of the dead man, by this time there's a bad odor because he's been there for 4 days. In a warm climate, a body after 4 days. Now, I'm a chemist. And there's a couple compounds that are produced when a body decays. One of them is called cadaverine. The other one's called putrescine. And that's those two compounds create that, you know, that smell? And within a couple days, that's what starts to happen. So Mary says, Jesus, are you sure you want to open up that? You sure? Now, I'm going to skip down because Jesus basically spoke to God and said, thank you, God, that you're doing this right now. All right, so verse 43. When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, take off the grave clothes and let him go. I love verse 45. Look at this. This is amazing. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed in him. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. If you were there and you saw him say, Lazarus, come out, 4 days after he was laid in there, and Lazarus walked out and they took, yeah, I could see why they believed in him. But you know what? Not everybody there believed in him. If you read on down, it says some of them went back to the Pharisees and said, do you hear what Jesus did? What are you going to do about it? Look at this in verse 47. What are we accomplishing, they asked. Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come. They'll take away our temple and our nation. Then one of them named Caiaphas, who was a high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than the whole nation perish. What prophetic words those were. So they decided to kill him. Now, did they decide to kill him because they thought he didn't work that miracle? No. They decided to kill him because they believed he worked that miracle. Because that made him a dangerous man. And really, to those who didn't believe in Jesus, he was a very dangerous man. So it was inevitable that he would have been killed. Then in Matthew 28:18, he says, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. So I want to go back to what Jesus said to Mary. She said to Mary, do you believe this? And again, if Jesus is not the resurrection and the life, then what is he? Certainly not a good person. Certainly not a model to be followed. And yet, given what we know about his life, is it rational to conclude that he was either a liar or a crazy person? The life he lived is inconsistent with that conclusion, even if you ignore the miracles that he worked. Because You know, he said to people, can any of you prove me guilty of sin? And they're all like, crazy. All right. In fact, even his family considered the possibilities out of his mind. But here's the question is, what do crazy people do? You know what crazy people do? They do crazy things. Did Jesus ever do something crazy? Well, it depends on your definition of crazy. How about saying to the Pharisees, you're a bunch of vipers in whitewashed tombs? That's a little crazy. Got him killed. The idea that Jesus was insane is inconsistent with the evidence. Some people say he's a liar. But what do liars do? They lie. And what lie can we accuse Jesus of? The lie, perhaps, of saying that I'm the resurrection and the life, but then he raised Lazarus from the dead. All right, now, I'm going to switch topics. I hope I don't, you know, drive you too crazy by switching topics, because I want to put that idea aside just for a moment. Let me leave you with this thought. Do you believe that? Do you believe that Jesus is who he says he is? That is the most important question you could ever ask. Now, what I want to do is I want to switch a little bit. I want to look at something that Jesus said in Luke 24:44. So forgive me, I'm going to move in a really different direction. We're going to come back to the same place, though, trust me. Luke 24:44, Jesus says something. He said to them, by the way, at this point, Jesus has been killed and been raised from the dead. Now, if you're a skeptic, I will forgive you for being skeptical about that, all right? If you're not a believer, I just said Jesus has been killed and raised from the dead. And if you're not just going to accept that because I said so, I can't blame you one bit, all right? But according to the Gospels, that's what's happened. All right, and so he is about to be raised, ascend, and so he's giving some of his final thoughts to his followers. Here's what he says. He said to them, this is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms. Now, the Jews divided their Bible into the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms. So Jesus is saying, I'm not quite ready to go because I've not quite finished fulfilling all that was said about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms. You know what? He's saying what he said back there, that he is the fulfillment. And basically what he's saying, there are many prophecies of the Messiah, and I've not finished fulfilling all those prophecies. That's why I can't leave yet. So what I want to do is I want to look at some of the prophecies in the Old Testament. Now, as I do this, I don't assume everybody in this audience understands certain background. For example, what if these things were written after Jesus lived? That would kind of cancel out the whole idea that they're prophecies. But the fact is we have this thing called the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is cave number 4, where the largest, actually, yeah, is that cave number 4? I think so. It's where the largest staff. What these are is hundreds and hundreds of manuscripts, many of which were Old Testament manuscripts. In fact, we have a manuscript of Isaiah from almost 200 years before Christ was born. This is a fact, an absolute incontrovertible fact, that all of these Old Testament prophecies were written hundreds of years before Jesus was born. In fact, there's this thing called the Septuagint translation, the translation of the Old Testament from Hebrew to Greek, 250 BC. Okay? So, just so you know, there's no reasonable possibility of doubt that these things were not written hundreds of years before the events. This is the Isaiah scroll from one sheet, obviously, of the Isaiah scroll from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Okay? Maybe people say, well, how do I know this thing really happened? Because, you know, maybe the Jews, you know, they read this testament, this prophecy. It says the Messiah will do this. So they'll say, well, we'll just say that he did that. The thing is, most of the prophecies we're going to look at are things that are a matter of historical record. For example, how he died which is recorded by Josephus, the Jewish historian, who was definitely not a Christian. Where he's born, where he was raised. All right, these are a matter of historical fact. Now, not all the prophecies we are going to look at are a matter of historical record outside the Bible, but almost all of them are. Tacitus, the Roman historian, who records, yes, there was this guy, yes, he was put to death, yes, by crucifixion, yes, under Pontius Pilate, etc. Okay? Good. Number three. How do I know that I'm not taking this out of context? For example, there's a verse that says he's going to come into Jerusalem on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. So how do I know that that's not just some random thing you took out of context? So what we're going to look at is we're going to look at a number of prophecies, and all but one of these prophecies are ones that the Jews had said were about their Messiah long before Jesus was even born. So we'll take the Jewish people's word for it. Yes, these are prophecies about their Messiah. Number four, again, we're just asking the question that a skeptic would naturally ask. All right, well, what if Jesus were to read in the Old Testament a prophecy of the Messiah that says he will ride into Jerusalem on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of the donkey? So then Jesus rents a donkey and rides into Jerusalem on that donkey. In fact, that specific prophecy, which is in Zechariah chapter 9, if you read the gospel accounts, it seems like that's actually what Jesus did. It seems that he actually arranged to fulfill that prophecy. So you'd say, well, maybe that explains it. But what we're going to find out is some of these prophecies, no, it doesn't work that way. Bear with me. I'll just give some examples. All right, great. Oh, besides, if Jesus wanted to fulfill all the prophecies in order to claim to be the Messiah, some of those prophecies involved getting killed. And if his plan was to start a religion and have everybody think he's so awesome, then getting killed is just not a really great sort of path to religious awesomeness. Okay, great. Here we go. Isaiah 53, 1 through 13. I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's a little bit long. I'm going to read certain parts of it. Okay, now, this is a prophecy from the book of Isaiah, the scroll of which we already saw. Isaiah wrote around 700 years B.C. All right? So this is back when Norway was being controlled by the Danish people, or maybe, I don't know, back when they were on their boats, you know, attacking the English people or something like that, okay? That's a long time. That's very... All right, got it? And this is a prophecy that the Jews themselves, during Jesus' lifetime, said, this is a prophecy about our Messiah. All right, let me read it. All right, let me see. Verse 3, saying of the Messiah, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of suffering, familiar with pain. Now, question number one, was Jesus despised and rejected? Yes. Is that a matter of historical fact? Yes. Could Jesus, wanting to claim to be the Messiah, have arranged to get despised and rejected? Yeah. By telling the Pharisees that are a bunch of brood of vipers. Yeah, okay. All right, I'll concede. Let me go down. Verse 4. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering, yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Now, this is a reference not to how Jesus died, but was done to him after he died. If you read the accounts, they crucified two criminals along with Jesus. And generally, when you're crucified, it took between 12 hours and 36 hours to die. Because actually, crucifixion doesn't cause that much bleeding. So it's just the most horrible, torturous way to die. But because Jesus had been so badly beaten, he died within 6 hours. All right? So So when the Jews said, this is blasphemy to have a crucifixion happening because it was the day of the Passover. So they said, put it to an end. So the soldiers came, they broke the legs of the thieves on either side. Because when you're being crucified, if you break the legs, they can no longer push up and they suffocate within a few minutes. They come to Jesus, he's already dead. So what did they do? They put a spear into his side. Now, could Jesus have arranged to get pierced like that? I guess so. Can you imagine him on the cross saying, hey guys, you're killing me, but you know, since you're killing me, can you do me a favor? Just trust me on this. I mean, you're killing me, so the least you could do is, you know, and just trust me, okay? Please, you know, pierce me. I'm sort of joking. But that doesn't really make sense. And by the way, it says he was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like he was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before his shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. Which is why he was ultimately killed, because he refused to defend himself. Let's look at another one. Micah chapter 5, verse 2. I'll just read it here. But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times. Now, help me out. Where was Jesus born? Bethlehem. There are two Bethlehems in Israel. The smaller of the two is Bethlehem Ephrathah. So if somebody wants to claim to be the Messiah, they have to get born in Bethlehem. Now, it's a historical fact that he was born in Bethlehem, number one. Could he have arranged to be born in Bethlehem? Well, the answer is, well, if he's God, I guess he could. Okay? What about Isaiah 9? All right, it says, in the past he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the future he'll honor Galilee of the Gentiles by way of the sea along the Jordan. For to us a child is born, he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now, if there ever was a messianic prophecy, it's certainly this one. And it says, contrary, in a sense, to Micah 5, that the Messiah will come from the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, from Galilee. Okay? Now, I'm going to show you a map. This is a map of the different tribes of Israel. One of them is Zebulun, and the other one is Naphtali. So according to Isaiah 9, the Messiah has got to come from right around here. Now, do you know where Jesus was raised and where he spent his youth? Right on the border of Zebulun and Naphtali. So if somebody wants to claim to be the Messiah, they have to have a very unusual resume, which is being born in Bethlehem and yet come from the region of Galilee, somewhere between Zebulun and Naphtali. All right, how about this, Psalm 22. This is maybe my favorite. All right, now this is David talking. David wrote Psalm 22 roughly 1,000 years B.C. Okay? He said, dogs have surrounded me, a band of evil men have encircled me, they have pierced my hands and my feet. Let me stop right there. I imagine David writing this down, blah, 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 blah. They have pierced my hands and my feet. And then saying to himself, why did I say that? Oh, let me keep going. All right, I can count all my bones. What am I talking about? Let me keep going. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. What did I just write? Seriously. I mean, how did this get there? Did you know that crucifixion was not even invented until 300 years before Christ? To go even further than that, the form of crucifixion, which involved actually piercing hands and feet, was invented by the Romans roughly 100 years B.C., 900 years after David wrote this. Is it historical fact that he was crucified? Yes. All right? Could Jesus have arranged to be crucified? You'll say, well, he kind of arranged to get killed. But actually, believe it or not, it was really hard for a Jew to get crucified. I'm not kidding. The reason is the Jews were not allowed to crucify. They could kill by stoning, but not by crucifixion. Only the Romans could crucify. But why would the Romans want to kill this guy? So the fact that he got crucified is actually quite surprising. They killed the thieves, that's because they were rebels against Rome. I can count all my bones. Now, this is a reference to the fact that although they broke the bones of the two neighbors, they didn't break Jesus' bones. Now, I will admit, this is a historical fact. Unmistakable. I will admit that this fact is only recorded in the Gospels. Okay? You know, let me be, you know, fully mention that. But here's the thing is, let's say that John is lying. Okay? Well, here's the thing. Most of you are teenagers, right? And all teenagers lie. So I know you guys all lie because you're teenagers. That's what teenagers do. That's what I did. Now, hopefully you don't lie a lot, but it's kind of comes with the territory, right? You know? You won't tell your parents, but, you know, but I'm telling you this. When you lie, you give as few details as possible, right? Because you want to cover your tracks. Because when they... Okay, probably you don't lie. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You don't lie. But I know I did a lot. I was a typical teenager. But I can remember, you don't want to reveal too much because when they start asking questions, you got to be able to kind of, you know, adjust your story. So why would John add a detail like that when there were hundreds of eyewitnesses, most of whom were still alive? Okay? And again, while Jesus was on the cross, they divided up his clothes, according to John. But then they came to his inner garment, which was a very special because it was woven. There was no seam in it. It was all one piece. And they said, oh, that's too valuable. So they gambled over it instead. Could Jesus have arranged for them to gamble over his garment? I guess. Hey, guys. Do you realize how valuable that is? All right. Now, if this was the only example of a prophecy of the Messiah, you could say, well, I don't know, maybe this, maybe that. But think about all these prophecies. Think about the case that's being made here. But I'm not done. Just a couple more, okay? What about Zechariah? Zechariah 11. Here, I told them, if you think it best, give me my pay, but if not, keep it. So they paid me 30 pieces of silver. And the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, the handsome price at which they priced me. So I took the 30 pieces of silver, I threw them into the house of the Lord to the potter. Now, help me out here. What, how much did Judas get for betraying Jesus? 30 pieces of silver. I like to imagine the Jewish leaders who paid him that 30 pieces of silver reading Zechariah a couple months later. And they go, oh, man, should have given him 100 pieces. Oh, sorry, there you go. I mean, it's kind of cool that God used those who killed Jesus to fulfill the prophecy. Now, if you read the account in Matthew, what happened was Judas had regret. In my opinion, Judas's plan was to sort of manipulate Jesus into rebelling against Rome. It didn't work because he didn't understand that Jesus' kingdom is not of this world. So rather than rebel, he got himself killed. And Judas is like, oh, man, I think he felt terrible for what he'd done. So he came back and he took the money and he said, take it back. And if you read in Matthew, they said, we can't take that money. It's blood money. So he just threw it on the ground and left. And rather than take that money, you know what they did with that money? They bought a potter's field. And they used it to bury Gentiles. And there's some interesting, the fact that it was used for Gentiles was kind of interesting as well. All right? And notice this. It says, This is in Zechariah. This is God speaking. He says, the handsome price at which they priced me. Who's me? In this context, God. God saying, I was betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. All right, last one. Daniel 9. All right, I guess I don't need to turn to these. You don't even need your Bible. You feel free to go back to the original scriptures and look in the context. I'm saying that these scriptures are all clearly messianic. By the one that's not clearly messianic is Psalm 22. The Jews would not have identified Psalm 22 as messianic. All the others they did. But remember, with Psalm 22, David's talking about piercing my hands and my feet. You're like, what else would it apply to? Certainly not to David. So here, by the way, if there is any messianic prophecy in the whole Old Testament, it's definitely Daniel chapter 9. Let me give you the background. So Daniel has been in captivity for 68 years. The year is 538 BC, and Cyrus has recently overthrown the Babylonian Empire. And if you read Daniel chapter 9, Daniel's reading Jeremiah 29, where it prophesied 70 years of captivity. Well, at this point, Daniel's been in a captivity for about 68 or 69 years. So he says, God, come on, let's get going. And then an angel comes and answers to his prayer, and he says, no, not 70 years, 70 times 7. So here we go. 70 sevens are decreed for your people, your holy city, to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Is this a messianic prophecy? In fact, the Hebrew word here is Messiah, Messiah. That's the word being used there. No one understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem into the anointed one, the Messiah, the ruler comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. Now, what is this decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem? Well, it just so happens that in Ezra chapter 7, there's a decree by Persian King Artaxerxes to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. It was given in the seventh year of Artaxerxes. And if you read the book of Nehemiah, it's the story of them actually doing it, going back and rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. That decree was issued, according to Ezra, in the year 458 BC. Now, 70 times 70 sevens is 490. Do we have any math people here? Any know a little math? Anybody with a little math skills? Nobody's going to admit it. Come on. Somebody here pointed. All right. He says you have math skills, okay? He pointed at you, so too bad. You're stuck. Please subtract 490 from 458. The answer is right there on the screen. It's right there on the screen. It's right there on the screen. All right, I'll get you. Negative 32, which would be the year 32 AD. Okay, see? No, not the year 32 AD, because there was no year zero. The calendar goes from 1 BC to 1 AD. Now, if you read a little further, 7 sevens and 62 sevens, if you analyze this scripture a little bit more carefully, what it really says is there's 70 weeks, 490 years. It basically says he will come to Jerusalem during that last week, which would mean somewhere between 26 and 33 AD. Now, if you want to claim to be the Messiah, anybody here in the room, sorry, you're kind of out of luck. You kind of missed the boat. Oh, that's right. You weren't. Was anybody here born in Bethlehem? Anybody here? Okay. So everybody realizes what we're talking about here, right? Okay, good. So anybody who's going to claim to be the Messiah, remember in Luke 24:44, Jesus says, I must fulfill all that was written about me. Well, some of the things that were written about the Messiah is that he must be born in Bethlehem. Although he must be born in Bethlehem, he must come from the region of Galilee, kind of near where Nazareth is. Must be despised and rejected, silent when accused, pierced and crucified, have his garments divided and gambled over, be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver, and come to Jerusalem somewhere around 30 AD or so, give or take 3 years. And in the process, make atonement for sin and bring in everlasting righteousness. Can you think of any other candidates? Pick any three. Is there anybody alive who meets three of those? Anybody alive today? Anybody alive ever who meets three of those conditions? So my conclusion is, and by the way, this is why I became a Christian. We had that chat earlier. Yes, kind of my history. Like I said, I came from a non-belief perspective. Then I came to have a sort of a general belief perspective, like there's something out there. But it's when I came across this kind of information, I kind of said, okay, that's my history. I said, okay, where do I sign up? All right, how about in Acts 2:36, brothers, what shall we do? You know, Acts 2:37. Right, that was what it was for me. Okay, now there's two options. I either stop now and take questions, or I spend a little bit of time talking about the resurrection. Maybe we could, I don't know, how long have I been speaking? I lost track.
I haven't checked. I have no clue.
Take the resurrection. All right, I'm going to spend a little bit of time on the resurrection. This would be the shortest of the three segments. So remember, the first segment was, who is this guy? Is the common understanding of Jesus that he is a great religious leader amongst many, is that a reasonable proposal? And I propose that that is not reasonable, not at all. Number two, all right, do we have any evidence to back this up other than just reading the New Testament? And then number three, what about the resurrection? Jesus said in John 3:19, destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days. In fact, that was the only charge against Jesus that was raised at his trial. They said, yeah, this guy said he's going to destroy the temple, which they misinterpreted, because what temple was he talking about? Jesus said, destroy this temple and I'll raise it again in 3 days. What was he talking about? He was talking about his body. Okay? All right, so I want to discuss the resurrection because, you know, there are things that are stated in the Bible that, honestly, I don't have any evidence for them. You know, we were talking about Adam and Eve. I have no direct evidence that there was somebody called Adam and Eve. I believe it just because it says so in the Bible, honestly. All right, I believe in heaven, and I have absolutely no concrete evidence pointing to heaven. You know why I believe in heaven? Because Jesus believes in heaven. But there's a few things I believe because of the evidence. For example, I believe Jesus is the Messiah because of the evidence that I can't argue with. I also believe Jesus was raised from the dead because of the evidence. Okay? So, I'm going to describe three things which I believe are as much a matter of fact from ancient history as anything. So, was Tiberius really the emperor of Rome? You know, can you prove that? Well, can you prove it? You can't prove anything from that long ago. But what you can say is, would any reasonable person conclude that, yes, in fact, Tiberius was emperor? And the answer is, as far as I know, all reasonable people say, yes, obviously he was. And that when I say fact, I mean not fact in the sense of fact that you're sitting here or fact that 2 + 2 = 4. I mean as much as things from history could be fact. That's what I mean by fact. So I'm using that word maybe a little bit loosely, okay? Fact number one, Jesus was crucified under Pontius Pilate in Jerusalem. And my claim is that is as much a fact of history as it is that, you know, that Alexander the Great conquered Persia. All right. The reason for that is I'm not going to read all these quotes, but people like Josephus, who had no possible reason to help the Christians out since he was a Jew, he said that Jesus was killed by Pilate. Why would he do that? I mean, he has no motivation. Or we could have Tacitus, who also said during the reign of Tiberius. By the way, there are, historians have counted how many ancient documents refer to this guy Tiberius directly. And right, so far, there are, at this point, as far as I know, there are something like 9 documents from ancient history that mention Tiberius. And it just happens there are also 9 documents from ancient history other than Jewish, other than Christian, ignore Christian mention. There are 9 non-Christians who mention Jesus. In other words, the amount of evidence for Tiberius Caesar and the amount of evidence for Jesus are roughly equal. All right? And then the Talmud. This is a Jewish document from the late 1st to early 2nd century, which says they hung Yeshu. Okay, so that Jesus was crucified is a fact. Fact number 2, that the resurrection was preached by Christians in Jerusalem in the immediate context of that time. In fact, if you talk to scholars who don't believe in Christianity at all, but those who know enough about the history of Rome and Christianity at that time, they will agree with this. Whether they don't agree that Jesus was resurrected, but they definitely agree that the Christian church from the beginning taught that he was resurrected. Not only did they teach that he was resurrected, they believed that he was resurrected. You cannot explain the history of Christianity unless you accept this as a fact. Number one, that they claimed he was resurrected there in Jerusalem and that they believed it. Otherwise, the growth in history of Christianity just doesn't even make any sense. Otherwise, it's this big, conspiracy of a bunch of people who didn't believe in it at all, and yet they all would get killed for it, even though they didn't believe in it. So I'm going to call this a fact. Fact number one, crucifixion. Fact number two, claim of resurrection and belief of resurrection. Point number three, the tomb was empty. Fact. I guarantee you. To doubt this is to also doubt things like that I have an arm, you know. Because if the tomb where he was laid was not empty, then, in fact, I just read Peter in Acts chapter 2. Okay, Acts chapter 2. Okay. Blah, blah, blah. In verse 32, God has raised this Jesus to life, and we are all witnesses of it. Okay? Now, if he said that in front of thousands, and thousands of Jews were converting and becoming Christians, then what would those who kind of knew where his body was, what would they have done? Obviously, they would have produced his body. The fact is, Christianity would have been insustainable unless the tomb was empty. Again, fact is that Jesus was crucified. If that's true, given the history of Christianity, then his resurrection was claimed and at least believed by some. And number three, the tomb was empty. Okay? So, now, there's a guy named David Hume. You might have heard of David Hume. He's a Scottish philosopher, the ultimate skeptic of all skeptics. And he made a statement. I kind of like it. He said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. I agree with that. If I said, yeah, there was a cow born with 5 legs, you know, really? But you know what? If 5 people you knew said it, they saw it and had a picture, you kind of go, oh, okay. But he said, yeah, Bill was raised from the dead. I mean, you know, it would be reasonable to expect some really, really solid support for that. You know, right? David Hume. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. Okay. Fact number four, what about this? In 1 Corinthians 15:6, Paul is talking about the resurrection. He says, after this, Jesus appeared to more than 500 of the brothers at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. So Paul, in addressing the Corinthian church, said, you know, the fact that Jesus was alive, there's 500 eyewitnesses. If you don't believe it, ask any of them. Just ask them. They'll tell you. And, you know, every single one of those eyewitnesses, you could threaten them with death. And none of them would ever change their story. Anyway. Okay. So what about it? So given that he was crucified, that the resurrection was believed, and that his tomb was empty, what are the possible explanations of these facts? Well, one possible explanation is, all right, he was dead, but somebody took the body. If that were true, it would agree with the fact that he was crucified. It would agree with the fact that his tomb was empty. And I guess possibly it could explain why some people believed he was resurrected. So the question is that a reasonable explanation? Explanation number two, well, he never really died. All right? So and then he kind of got out of the tomb, and that would explain why the tomb was empty, because he wasn't even dead. Out of that, number three, it's because he was actually raised from the dead. As far as I know, nobody's ever proposed any alternatives. In other words, the only explanations ever given to the crucifixion, the empty tomb, and the belief in his resurrection are these three. Okay? So, you know, you can check it out online if you want. I don't think you'll find anything else. Well, there's the mass hallucination theory and stuff, crazy stuff. Okay, good. So, is it possible that they stole his body? Well, question number one. Well, who would steal his body? Would the Jews have stolen his body? The answer is maybe. In order to make sure that nobody could claim he was raised from the dead, because he did say, destroy this temple and I'll raise it in 3 days. And Jesus more than once said things that implied that he'd be raised from the dead on the third day. So, you know, it's possible, because the Jewish leaders had a lot of clout and a lot of money. It's possible they could have stolen his body, but if they did, they would have presented it immediately. So there's no way the Jews did. What about the Romans? Could or would the Romans have stolen the body? For what? I mean, you cannot propose any possible reason the Jews would have stolen his body. What about the disciples? Would they have stolen his body? Well, they're the last ones who would have stolen his body. Why would they want to steal his body? So they can later claim that he was raised from the dead and live a lie for the rest of their life and live for the rest of their life under threat of death because of something they didn't even believe in? What? Would the Christians... Why? Why would the Christians have stolen his body? All right, let's just say they did. They said, hey, I've got an idea. Hey, guys, you know, we believed in Jesus. It was awesome for a time, but he's dead now. So what are we going to do? Just go home? We can't do that. I mean, it'd be embarrassing. So let's do this. Let's create a religion, you know, around the fact that he's Messiah. So let's steal his body. Great. Did you hear about the guard at the tomb? The Roman soldiers, the most well-trained, highly equipped soldiers in the world at that time. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to, you know, karate chop them and just wipe them all out. And then nobody will notice. I mean, you know, the next day, the fact that they're all dead and few of us are dead also, and nobody, you know, seriously. This idea is, I don't want to use a disrespectful word. Ridiculous, ludicrous, outrageous. I mean, No sane person could believe this. His body was not stolen. Because, first of all, you can't even propose somebody who'd have a reason. The only ones who had a possible reason to was the Jews. All right, so I guess they lost it later or something like that. I mean, okay, good. What about the idea that he didn't actually die? Now, that would explain why people saw him alive later. It would also explain why the tomb was empty. So let's investigate that one, okay? So here's the deal. Now, Jesus was beaten. And if you understand what a flogging was like, just see the movie, the Passion of the Christ, all right? This guy has been beaten to the point virtually of death. No water for almost 4 days, no food. He's been crucified. And I'm telling you, folks, Roman soldiers know what a dead person looks like. And, you know, people say, well, maybe he passed out. You cannot pass out. Oh, it's all right. I remember one time I was teaching my lecture. I was teaching a lecture for my students and the phone was going off. So I stopped the lecture right then and there. I'm like, and they're like, oh, it's mine. So I give people a lot of grace on that, you know. We need to give them grace. Okay, slideshow from present slide. Okay, good. So what are we proposing here? So no food, no water, beaten nearly at the point of death. And then I'm telling you, if you know much about crucifixion, the way it would work is if you hang all your weight, if you know some physics, you know, the sine of theta, blah, blah, the amount of force on the arm is insane, all right? And the only way to breathe is to push up on your feet, all right? Otherwise, you suffocate. And that's why when they broke their bones, they died within a few minutes, because if you can't push up, then you die of suffocation. So if somebody is hanging limp on the cross, they are dead. All right, and add to that the fact that even though he was already dead, no question about it, they shoved a spear up into his side. And according to John, when they did so, separate water and blood came out, which shows that his blood had already separated, which happens at least an hour after his death. Here's this guy who's been beaten to the point of near death, no water for 3 or 4 days. He's been killed, obviously, and then given a mortal wound anyway. And he kind of wakes himself, brushes himself off, moves this massive stone, and then sort of, you know, has a little battle with all those Roman soldiers. And, you know, I'm sorry. This does not make sense. So, again, we're back to three possibilities. Sorry for all that stuff. I believe Jesus was raised from the dead. And if Jesus was raised from the dead, then that validates his claims about himself. Certainly not a liar. Certainly not a crazy person. I believe Jesus was raised from the dead. The mass hallucination theory doesn't make any sense. All right? So, because Jesus fulfilled the prophecies of the Messiah, and because he was resurrected, the only reasonable conclusion I have is that Jesus is who he says he is, the Son of God, the bread of life, the resurrection and the life, in fact, God in the flesh. So, we can take some questions or comments, and you could ask a question from any area. On my website, I've answered over 2,500 questions. So, you know, that's kind of what I do, I guess, to some extent, is answer questions. So, surely you have some. Yeah?
I'm reading a translation once about after when he came back, that you can still see, like, the points of this in his hands.
Right, when Thomas, because he appeared to the first to the women, and then to Peter and John. Then he appeared to the apostles except for Thomas. And then he came back when Thomas was there. And Thomas was skeptical, so he said, here, touch. I believe especially touch the wound in his side there, yeah. So what's the question?
So if he never really died. No, I just made sense.
Okay, good. Think about it. There probably was a core question in there, and you probably spaced it. So
yeah.
Come back. Yeah.
So we can't all of us get an education in this, but how would you recommend learning more about theology and facts about the Bible?
More about what?
Facts about the Bible, theology, these sources.
Yeah.
What are reliable sources?
Yeah. You're setting me up here. I've written a book called Reasons for Belief, and I brought several copies with me. Okay, and maybe if a high school student buys it, I'll give it an extra discount here. And so this is just one chapter in that book. So there's a chapter about scientific things as it relates to Christianity. There's a chapter about the reliability of the New Testament, Old Testament text. It's a chapter about history and archaeology and its relationship to Christianity. So that book covers a lot of the kind of things that I think a person who's just kind of trying to decide where their faith is going to lie. It's called Reasons for Belief, and the intention of that book is to establish reasons for belief. There's a thing on messianic prophecy. There's a chapter on the claims of Jesus. Several things like that. So that's a suggestion. I think some of C.S. Lewis's stuff is really good. His book Mere Christianity, which is more of a theological. That's a really great book. There's plenty of others I could suggest. Depends on the question that you have, because some books are more focused than on just one question. So my book, Reasons for Belief, was intended kind of be a shotgun approach. Okay? I've also got a book called Is There a God?, which is kind of just deals with the scientific question. And another one called Field Book for Christian Apologetics, which is a collection of about 300 or so questions from my website. Kind of, that's another possibility. But there's plenty of authors out there. Yeah. Okay. I know that teenagers ask a lot of questions, and sometimes they're afraid to ask. And in fact, sometimes the parents don't want the teenagers to ask because those questions are kind of, you know. So I bet there's a question that you've had you haven't asked yet. Let's go for it. I know there is. I know there is. Maybe somebody whose parents not here. How many of you have parents who are actually here? Oh, never mind.
What we also can do if you have some questions and you think it's a little difficult to ask. We will have a little hangout and
All right. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take one of the questions that came to me off to the side, and I gave a very inadequate answer because we were about to come in here. So I was asked, how does a scientist deal with evolution and simultaneously with the Bible? That's surely that's something you guys think about. So I'm going to give a little bit better treatment of that. Okay. Now, first of all, if I read in Genesis chapter 1, here's my very brief outline. My very brief outline of Genesis 1 is God created the universe, God created the earth, he created water and then land which emerged from the water, he put life in the water and then life on the land. In fact, all species, last of all human beings. I'd say, okay, yeah, that's That's pretty much about right. Now, I don't believe that those days are actual 24-hour periods. In fact, if you understand Near Eastern literature, it doesn't even really make sense to think of them as literal 24-hour periods. In fact, even Jewish philosophers like Philo in the first century said, these days are metaphorical in nature, that they simply describe the successive stages by which God created the universe. Okay. Well then, the Bible says God created all species, but it doesn't say how. Now, I quoted from Galileo. Galileo said, the Bible told us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. What he's trying to say is the Bible is not a book about science. It's not a book about cosmology. It's a book about God. So probably, and he also said, in the matter of sensory perceptions, we should begin with sensory observation, not with the Bible. So, for example, in questions about the age of the earth or whether or not the earth moves, things like that, we should allow nature to speak, because that's what nature does, is speak in those areas. So I would say that the Bible does not say how God created the different species. But science tells us how God did it. It says that he did it at least in part through this process that we know of as evolution. All right? And evolution is a beautiful thing. Basically, God allows the random mutations that occur naturally to cause species to be able to adapt to changing environments. And as the environment changes, species have to change with it. So the way I see it is, God invented evolution. And so where does the theory of evolution go counter to what the Bible says? I have trouble thinking of one. All right. Now, I personally believe that evolution was not a fully random, God-independent process. My personal belief, based on things like the Cambrian explosion and certain other statistical problems with the rate of mutation, I personally believe that God has intervened in that process at different times and in different ways. However, that belief is not a scientific belief. That is a theological proposal, not a scientific proposal. So this belief has no place in a science classroom. So if I was in a science classroom, what I would do is I would present the only working model that explains the fossil evidence and the genetic evidence for the origin of species, which is evolution by natural selection. So as a Christian, I have no problem with evolution. In fact, why do Christians get defensive about evolution? Since God invented evolution, so why not just give him credit for it? So again, now there are Christian believers who are very strongly tied to a literal interpretation of Genesis 1. In other words, they are convinced that these days are literally, 24 hours followed by 24 hours followed by 24 hours. Okay, it's not my place to tell them what to believe. But I would say if that's true, then you have to explain why the evidence for common descent and fossils like dinosaurs 65 million years ago. So how do you explain that? All right, so God created the earth a few thousand years ago, then he put dinosaur bones in the ground. Is that your explanation? That's a little strange. And by the way, when we look through a telescope at a galaxy that is 1 billion light years away, how long ago did the photons hitting our telescope and creating the image, how long ago did those photons leave that galaxy?
1 billion.
1 billion years ago. So if the universe is only a few thousand years old, my question is, all right, well, does that galaxy even exist? That would be strange. I mean, God could do whatever he wants. He could create a universe with light already in transit from that God, I guess. So anyway, I believe that Genesis 1 is a theological description, not a scientific description. And yet, interestingly, the basic outline agrees with what I know from science. And evolution, I believe in that as a theory that explains the data. Okay? So that's a little bit more thorough answer to your question. Yeah?
In Genesis 9:29, it says, Noah lived a total of 950 years when he died.
Yeah. By the way, I mean, again, like I said, I think this is important, especially for younger people. As you're reading the Bible and trying to understand where you sit in relation to whether you believe in it or not, you have to ask yourself, do I believe this because of the evidence? Or do I believe this because the inspired Bible says this? So let me tell you a few things I believe because of the evidence. I believe the universe was created because of the evidence. Okay? I believe life was created because of the evidence. Not species, life. I believe the Bible is inspired by God because of the evidence, such as that presented tonight. And I believe that Jesus was raised from the dead because of the evidence presented tonight. I believe in Adam and Eve primarily because it says so in the Bible. And I'm not going to say anything different. I lost track. Genesis 9. Oh, yeah. So I believe this to be true. I have no evidence to back it up. None whatsoever. I believe it to be true. But in order to explain that, I have to make up a theory. This is called an ad hoc theory. Have you ever heard of an ad hoc theory? An ad hoc theory is a theory that you make up not because of the evidence, but to explain something that you already believe. All right? So here's my ad hoc theory, and feel free to reject it. And I will not be the slightest bit hurt at all. I believe that Adam and Eve were created with more perfect genetics than we have. In fact, you know, people ask, who did Cain marry? His own sister? Isn't that, yucky, gross, disgusting? That's not yucky, gross, or disgusting. It's dangerous. And the reason it's dangerous is because we have genetic material in us, which is produced by mutations, which if you get two copies of that recessive gene, that's not good. But I believe for Adam and Eve, they didn't have these genetic problems. So I believe that would explain why they lived longer and why their children could also marry each other. But I'm telling you, the reason I believe this is because it's in the Bible. Okay? And is that the incorrect explanation? It could be. It could be there's something in Jewish literature. It could be there's something about the way Jews wrote things. But I'm not aware of that. And it could be there's another explanation for why the Bible describes it that way. But if so, I don't know what that is. So that's what I'm sticking with. Okay? Yeah.
If I may have just had two sons, how do you go from there? In the Bible, it
always says Adam and Eve, yeah. According to the Bible, actually, it's three sons, not two.
Three.
Seth. Okay? Cain, Abel, and Seth. Now, according to the Bible, now I'm accepting in this context that the Bible's true, okay? That the accounts are true. According to this, Adam and Eve lived a few hundred years. All right, so let's see. The average woman, let's say, lives to be about 75. Of those 75 years, how many years is she able to have children? Of those 75 years, roughly about 25 of those years. So let's say Eve lived to be 500. 500 divided by 3. That's about 167 years. So she was viable to have children for 167 years. How many children did she have? I'm assuming that she and Adam, you know, had sexual relationships. I don't know. 70? I don't know how many children she had. I have no idea. I assumed she had many. Now, the Bible only mentions three of them. The Bible doesn't tell us everything. In fact, 99.99999999% of all things that ever happened are not mentioned in the Bible. And the Bible only mentions very, very few things. And for example, in the life of Jesus, it only mentions one thing that happened when he was 12, a couple of things that happened when he was an infant, and then a few things that happened during a 3-year ministry. So I don't know how many children Adam and Eve have. I don't know how many daughters they had. I don't know how many sons they had. But I assume that they had many. And yeah, because it seems, according to Genesis, but a time came, went out, and, you know, there were populations, right? But if the average person had 50 children, then within 4 generations, what would the population be? Well, you could do the math on that. It would be somewhere close to 1 million. So that's my answer. Again, I'm speculating on facts I don't know about, but it's the only reasonable answer. Okay, yeah.
In the Old Testament, God spoke pretty directly to the people. Why did he stop? Or not stop, but why is this not as direct as he used to?
Right, that's a good question. Now, actually, if you take the entire history of Israel, he spoke only very, very rarely. Let's say from the time of Abraham to the time of Jesus, if you add up the number of years over which he was speaking directly to the people, it was actually the exception, not the rule. Nevertheless, he did. And, you know, I have to kind of give a big picture answer. Hopefully I don't lose you. But see, I'm going to do something. I'm going to do an aside and then I'm going to come back. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to summarize. Whoops. That's okay. I'm going to summarize the entire Bible. Okay, here we go. Genesis 1, God created everything and it was good. Genesis 2, he created human beings so that we could love him, he could love us, and we would love one another. Genesis chapter 3 and 4, we rebelled against God, we lost that intimate relationship, and we were kicked out of the garden. Genesis 5 through Revelation 20, God is fixing the problem. Revelation 21 and 22, God fixed the problem. Now, from Genesis 5 to Revelation 20, it's a story, and the story is this. The story is God chose a man, his name was Abraham, and through Abraham, he created a people. The Jews. And to those people, he gave a land. And he gave a law. And he gave prophets. And all of these were so that he could eventually send the Messiah. It says in Hebrews 1, in the past, God has spoken in various times and in various ways. But in these last days, he's spoken to us through Jesus. Jesus is the last revelation. And we don't need more revelation. In fact, in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, he says, God sent some people to talk to them, and he says, they have the Moses. If they have Moses, if they don't listen to Moses, they're not going to listen to anything else. So God, that was his plan. His plan was to create a people and a place and a law. And a testament in order for Christ to come to fulfill that testament. All right, and so that would explain why God spoke more directly, because it was part of his plan. And at this point, our revelation is Jesus, which is the greatest revelation of all. All right, and in Hebrews 11, you know, it says basically they had these things about the Messiah more indirectly, but we have it very directly. We've seen these prophecies fulfilled. So, So because we have the Old and the New Testament, and we have Jesus, God has said essentially that's my final word until I come back. Now you can say, well, God, I don't really like that. I think you should have done this, that, or the other thing. But that's what God decided to do, and I believe that explains why he decided to do it that way. But again, you know, we think God was working miracles for the Jews all the time. God worked miracles only very, very rarely. Only, you know, during the time of Moses directly, and the time of David, you know, through almost the entire history of the Jews, he did not work miracles. In fact, that's one of the complaints of the Jews in the Old Testament, which is, why aren't you working miracles anymore? Okay? Great questions. See, what you all are doing is asking the same questions that I was asked. I'm always asked. So, go for it. How are we doing? It's almost 8:30. It's Friday night. You guys, did everybody have dinner? Are you hungry? Maybe one or two more questions. All right, maybe we could allow one or two adults to throw in maybe one or two softball questions. Anybody back there? An adult who's thinking of a question they're pretty sure a teenager is asking, but they haven't asked yet. Okay, go for it.
You mentioned when you talked about Jesus that not Christian people or Jewish people was talking about Jesus.
Yeah.
Is there other examples of that where people who aren't Christian write about?
Yes. I can give you, you can go to my website. There, like I said, there are either 8 or 9, depending on who you count, non-Christian authors in the first century or very early second century who specifically mention Jesus. One of them is a guy named Suetonius. Another, it's a Roman historian. Another one is Tacitus, a Roman historian. A third one is Pliny the Younger, who talked, he was asking the emperor for advice what to do with the Christians. Another one is Josephus. The Jewish Talmud, the writer of the Jewish Talmud. There are 3 others. And so if you read my book, Reasons for Belief, it mentions them. Or if you go to my website, you could type in maybe, figure out a search word. You'll find it really quickly. A guy named Ben Sarapian, and then another guy named, I forget. One of the interesting ones is this guy who spoke in about the 50s AD, who was trying to explain the darkness that occurred in Jerusalem at the time of the crucifixion. And his name is Thallus. And he says the reason for the darkness at the time of Jesus' crucifixion was because there was a total eclipse of the sun. So that proves, number one, that it was generally claimed by Christians that the darkness happened. Number two, that an enemy of Christianity believed that it did in fact happen, sufficient that he felt like he needed to explain it. But the problem is, scientists know every total eclipse of the sun that has ever happened in the last, because we can do calculations for tens of thousands of years. I'll tell you one thing, there was definitely not a total eclipse of the sun. So there's one thing. Thallus, writing in the 6th century AD. And so there's roughly 9. And by the way, and then if you add the Christians who speak about Jesus and what he said and he did, there's between the time of Christ and about, say, 120 AD, there's something like 13 sources. And what the skeptics do is they say, we ignore those completely. Okay, so these people, why would you ignore them? I mean, give me a reason to ignore them. You know, in asking, what do you believe about Julius Caesar? They don't say, well, we refuse to listen to any Roman sources on Julius Caesar because they're biased. Well, if you did that, then you wouldn't have any sources. So really, why would you dismiss Christians as giving legitimate information about Jesus? That really doesn't make sense. So there's those 9 sources. I listed most of them. And then, of course, there's Christians like who died for their faith, who said a few things. I believe they spoke accurately. Let me make another point. People say, oh, but they wrote so much later. How can you believe what they said? They wrote so much later. Okay, well, Mark was written probably in the 50s AD, certainly no later than the early 60s. So he wrote 30 years after the event. All right, so I'm telling you, I lived in San Diego 30 years ago. Do you think I would be deceived about that? Do you think I can remember what happened 30 years ago? This idea that that they could pull a fast one, they could pull some sort of a, make up some story 30 years later, they act as if it's such a long time. It's not a long, 30 years is not a long time. To you, it may seem like a long time, but to me, it seems like, just a few years ago. So this idea that they could have created this myth about Jesus, given that the people, including the unbelievers who were there, were still around, really, it's kind of ludicrous in my opinion. All right, one more question. And again, you three out back there, you three old people, feel free to throw in that question you're hoping somebody's going to ask. Or not, it's up to you. Okay. I guess we're done.
Very good.
Thanks. Oh, wait. I want to get a picture. Almost forgot. Yeah, come back over there, Libby. Okay, here we go. Thank you. I'm going to post it on Facebook. All right, I think I got it. I got the side of your head. All right, so I didn't quite. All right. There we go. Oh, now I got everybody. Thanks.
Perfect, thanks. I'm not going to say anything more than it was great. It's very encouraging to just get like a better view of